floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hello, hello, hello. And welcome to another edition of Walking the Floor. With me, your host as always, Chris Shiflett. How you guys doing? I'm a little tired today. A little jet lagged, a little sore. And I'm sitting in a London hotel room recovering from a big cold weekend out at Milton Keynes, where we had a couple of great gigs. And then I spent my night off last night playing five-a-side over in Chelsea with Buddy Lee and the boys. And I actually scored 2 goals, man. I don't want to brag, but that was pretty fun. So, Arson, if you're listening, call me, buddy. I can help. Anyway, moving on. Today, we're heading up to Edinburgh. We're going to make up our canceled gig from earlier in the summer at Murray Field. So looking forward to that. All in all, life is just grand. Okay. On today's episode, I'm talking to co-founder and frontman of the Drive-By Truckers, Mr. Patterson Hood, who I'd never met prior to this interview, but I cold emailed him like, I don't know, a year and a half ago and asked if I could interview him, and he was nice enough to say yes. And then it was just a matter of being in the same place at the same time and linking up our schedules, which finally happened back in April of this year when the Truckers' acoustic tour came through L.A., and normally, I don't really like talking much with my guests before an interview, but this time was a little different. We met up for lunch at a Mexican restaurant down on Hollywood Boulevard before heading over to the studio over at Side One Dummy Records to have a little chat. And the first thing I noticed about Patterson was that his speaking voice isn't really all that different from his singing voice, which I think is part of the reason that he's one of those artists that you feel like you know, even though you don't really. I think his songs are another big part of that. And by the time the interview started, I felt like I was just talking to an old friend. And we ran through all kinds of stuff, like the history of the Truckers, family life, and the joys of sneaking through his dad's record collection to educate himself about music. Patterson's a great guy, and it was really fun talking to him and hanging out with him that day. So I'll let you hear him tell it. Check it out. Patterson Hood, Walking the Floor.
When he reached the gates of heaven, he didn't understand.
Well, I'm going to probably wind up asking you about some of the same shit that we talked about at lunch.
All right.
So I'll pretend that I don't know what your answer is going to be.
Well, hopefully it'll match up.
I guess why don't we start, tell me about the acoustic tour you guys are doing.
Yeah, it's called The Dirt Underneath. And we did this 8 years ago in a real kind of different era for the band when we were having this, we'd just come out of a lot of turmoil and a lot of problems. And it was Jason Isbell used to be in our band.
Sure.
And it was right when he had left, and it was a huge kind of gaping hole in the band musically when he left. And we felt like just to go out, have just some other guitar player step in, it would have just been kind of gross and wouldn't have really worked. So we stripped it down to just the bare essentials of you know, song and acoustic guitars, and went out on tour that way, and then just kind of rebuilt our band from the ground up during the course of the tour, and workshopped songs for what became our next record then, which ended up being one of our better records, Brighter Than Creation's Dark. And so we always talked about doing it again because it was fun. It was a great experience, that tour and everything. And we've been just busy doing this or that. Just kind of the time seemed right now. And it's fun to go out and do it without all the baggage of having to do it for some negative reason.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, was there another cathartic thing?
We're like at the absolute pinnacle best time of our band's history, as far as just the lineup's killer. Everybody gets along great.
Right.
We're having a good time. Everybody's being really creative, and there's no vices or problems that are causing issues. You know, there's really no issue. No drama. And
I was actually going to ask you about that, because, I mean, obviously everybody knows, like, you guys have had a lot of member changes over the years. Like, many, as a matter of fact, if you go to your Wikipedia page.
It's embarrassing, you know.
Well, if you go to your Wikipedia page, there's like somebody made like a color-coded chart of all your members and when they were in at what time.
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But that was one of the things I wanted to ask you you know, are you, and you and Mike Cooley have been the two consistent guys the whole time.
We're 30 years this August.
Are you guys just, you don't seem hard to deal with? Is there something like, what would your former band members say? Like, why do you think you've had so many different member changes over the years?
I mean, there's no telling what they'd say, but in all fairness, I think a lot of it, I mean, the road is brutal.
Right.
You know, we've spent, you know, our band's lifetime is longer than most bands' lifetimes.
Sure.
You're in a long time band, you know, but there aren't many of us. There aren't many 20-year-old bands.
Exceptionally fragile things.
You know, and you know, any normal people like Cooley and I would have probably broken up, you know. I mean, hell, we probably should have broken up in 91 when our first band broke up, when Adam's House Cat broke up. We just kind of didn't get the memo that you're supposed to quit playing together when your band breaks up. And so we started another band and then another band, and the Truckers was actually our fourth band together. And,
oh, really?
And that was 96. So we're 19 years now.
Wow.
And we've played, you know, what, 2,000 plus shows. I mean, we've played an enormous number of shows, and so things are going to break, you know. And you know, and unfortunately, you know, there's, you know, you have members in the band at times that just can't deal with the road, or they start drinking too much, or you know, we lose the focus, you know, lose the love for it, you know, and I'm sure they lose the love for us too, you know. But I don't think we're terrible. I don't think we're terrible people to deal with.
I don't seem like it.
You know, we're both pretty extreme people.
Right.
But most musicians and artists are, you know.
I think it's interesting to me that your band, I mean, not only have you had a lot of members through the years, but it seems like lots of different people write. I mean, I know you and Mike are obviously the main writers in the band, but when other people have been in the band, they've also contributed. That's pretty abnormal for a band.
It is.
Was that intentional? Like, did you set out with that in mind, or has it just always
not
been
really
this open door policy? If you are in the band, you're a songwriter, we'll give it a fair shake.
I mean, when we first started the band, I thought of it more of as a collective than a band.
Hmm.
The very beginning days. And partly out of, you know, when Cooley and I's third band together broke up, there was a falling out between us. We went a couple of years where we, you know, barely spoke, really, really, you know, weren't close and didn't really keep up with each other much. And during that time, I really grew to miss what he brought to the table, you know. Mm. And as far as, you know, I wrote all the songs in our early bands together. He actually wasn't writing songs that I knew of then. He might have been secretly doing it, but I would tell him he ought to, and he's like, you know, and he, you know, I mean, we were teenagers when we started playing together, so, you know, we fought and just, you know, were, you know, treated each other, I'm sure, terribly in the early days. But by the time we started the Truckers, part of starting that band was to try to lure him back into playing with me.
Mm.
And we lived in different towns, so I had to make it open-ended to where he could be there when it was convenient, but he wasn't required to be there. So I kind of built the band around this, like, other seat that sometimes was full and sometimes not. And we had more members than probably we really could handle having at the time, but it was kind of open door for everybody. And everybody in Athens plays in 20 bands anyway. And I was a new kid in town. No one really knew me. I didn't have anything going on. So most of the people that were playing with me, you know, I felt lucky to have them give me a day or two here or there for my project.
Sure.
And so that was the original lineup of the band. And then when it started solidifying, then it became a matter of who, you know, who was willing to actually take this thing that was, instead of it being a day here or a day there, all of a sudden a tour, you know.
Right.
And so that was the first round of personnel changes, was building a band that could actually tour.
Right.
And by then, Cooley was, I mean, pretty quickly that empty chair was almost never empty. I think he might have missed five shows the first year, and from then on it was he and I, you know.
Was there a specific turning point when it went from, you know, being a collective or whatever, just kind of ragtag band of people, to becoming something that you knew was going to be more full-time? Like, was there a specific point that you thought to yourself, I could do this for a life? Like, I could be an artist or musician, whatever you want to call it.
You know, I had come to terms before I started this band with the fact that I was never going to make it in music. Mm. It was never going to happen for me. But I decided I wasn't giving up anyway. I was still going to do it. And it's like, I didn't have kids, you know, and I didn't, you know, I had kind of a nihilistic, you know, attitude about living long anyway. So it's like, this is what I do.
Yeah.
I'm an artist. God damn it. You know, I don't, you know, if I'll starve, whatever. It all sounded so noble and romantic, you know. And so I kind of had lived that and started this band. But there came a point early on with this band. In our very earliest days, we got farther than any of the previous bands I'd ever had. I mean, I'd never had a band that had sold out a show, even a small, tiny room show. And the Truckers almost immediately would sell out this little, 250, 300 person room in Atlanta every time we'd come to town. And there's people were like excited to see us. It's like, wow, we found something that's clicking, you know?
Yeah, how'd that happen?
And so when we finished the second record, Pizza Deliverance, we all decided this is it. You know, Cooley and I both kind of came to this moment of we were already an older guys for a brand new band. I mean, we were well into our 30s when this band really got going. Mm. And it's like, you know, this is our chance. And if this don't work, then, you know, this is our chance. And so we all collectively quit our jobs and just took off. We booked a tour, and I booked most of it myself. And we played, I don't remember how many shows that year, but it was over 150 shows that year. We just took off and just started playing all the time. So that was, you know, it was a four-piece band. We were lean and mean. That's the band that made Pizza Deliverance and then made the live record, Alabama Ass Whooping, around that, you know, the next year.
Yeah.
And we ended up with Brad full-time on drums because the drummer we had before him was in five bands and, you know, he wasn't able to do it full-time. And Brad was gung-ho. It's like, yes, I'm there, you know. And so that was, you know, and so it never really even occurred to us from that moment on that, you know, we weren't going to make this work on some kind of level, you know. We didn't know that all the stuff that ended up happening a couple of years later with Southern Rock Opera was going to happen, because we didn't plan around that. That was a huge turning point.
Right.
That was when all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden we had a booking agent and we ended up, you know, we ended up with a record deal. You know, we put it out ourselves initially, but after we sold about 10,000 of them just out of the back of vans, we ended up getting signed and we got, you know, a 4-star review in Rolling Stone, which as an unsigned band is kind of a big deal. And, and all of a sudden just the size room started growing, you know, and there was just this different level of attention.
Mm. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was record labels and the music business. You guys have been on a lot of different, you know, almost as many record labels as you've had band members at this point. I mean, it's been a whole bunch of them. How do you think? What's the upside of the sort of splintering of the traditional record business for a band like you guys?
It probably opened the door for it. It probably opened the door for us to do what we did. You know, we. Our timing was really great. We had one of my best friends in the world to this day, and has been for 25 years, was a web designer when the internet was brand new. She was like, she kind of was like, oh, that's the future. This is what I'm going to get into. And she got into doing that. And she to this day does our website. She built us a website in like 97, 98, something like that, you know, around the time we put the first record, probably before the first album came out, we already had a website. And so we really built a lot on just having a web presence when that was a we had a website years before REM had a website.
Really?
And they're a forward-thinking, a mainstream big band, but also a very progressive, forward-thinking band of their time, their forever. And we were kind of into that early, and when we were trying to do Southern rock opera, we knew we'd bit off more than we could really chew. We had this idea for this record we wanted to make, and we had this very specific vision for how we wanted it to feel and sound and how we wanted it to be packaged even. I mean, everything about it was very thought out over just many, many van drives. That was what we would do to entertain ourselves, is we would just brainstorm about this crazy fucked up idea we had for
this is before for you actually made the record.
Yeah, we spent six years in that whole project was a 6-year thing from the first idea of it to it actually came out was a 6-year process that predated even the forming of the band by a few months. And so it's this kind of crazy thing, and we didn't have any money to make it, so we thought, well, you know, maybe we'll find some kind of, maybe if someone will pay for it, you know, we'll find a label or something. And so we went and we got invited to do South By and got a really nice showcase in front of a lot of people. A lot of people came to it. It was sold out in the big room on 6th Street and nobody. We actually got one offer, and it was so ridiculously terrible that I sat down with our friend David Barbie, who produces our records now, and we sat there and did the math and figured out how long it would take for that deal to bankrupt us if we took that deal. And based on what we were making selling our merch, that, you know, selling our CDs that we were pressing up for a couple of bucks a piece, losing that in exchange for this tiny guarantee and the restrictions that were going to come with it. And so we turned it down. And so we went out and we basically did what Kickstarter does before that was invented. And we went online and put the word out that we were looking for investors to do this record. And so we raised, our goal was $30,000, and we ended up raising, I think about $24,000, I think we raised. And we'd already recorded the record by that time, but we financed that just out of playing gigs, and that was brutal. We made that record for $5,000.
Did you have like a home studio or something, or how did you guys do that?
We used like DA-88s, those TAC DA-88s. We had two of those we chained together, and we recorded it in the upstairs of a uniform shop in Birmingham, Alabama. And Cooley's wife's family owns this uniform shop, and the upstairs at that time was this empty like storage area.
Oh, wow.
So they just let us go up there after hours. It was brutally hot during a heat wave and no air conditioning. We had to turn the fans off when we were tracking.
How'd you keep everything in tune, man? That's crazy.
It's not. It's part of why the record sounds the way it does.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Some of which is probably for the benefit of the record.
Yeah.
And some not. But I mean, that record was as close as we could get to the thing in our head with $5,000 and a uniform shop, basically, to make it.
Was the success of that, was that what led you? Didn't you guys sign to Mercury at one point?
We signed
you
were on with, a major label. Yeah, Lost Highway.
Okay.
Which I guess is a subsidiary. And they signed us about 10 months after Southern Rock Opera came out, and they re-released Southern Rock Opera. And gave it a little push and you know, sold a bunch more copies than they got it in stores, which we couldn't do. And then we made the follow-up record under that umbrella. But when we turned it in, they didn't really like it. They didn't really like Decoration Day. And it's ironic because that's everybody's favorite record of ours now, But and probably the one I'm proudest of especially of the earlier era stuff. But they didn't really, you know, they didn't get it. And
God, if so, I had a nickel for every time I heard essentially this same story.
Yeah.
From a musician. I mean, this is the classic tale. We made a crazy record. We turned it into our label and they didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then that record goes on to be everybody's favorite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so we essentially bought the record back from them for what they had put into it and then turned around and sold it to New West. And they put out the next five records, I guess, something like that. And it's funny because by that time we had management, and honestly, the management we had at the time didn't negotiate as good a deal with New West as we had negotiated ourselves with Lost Highway for whatever, you know, it wasn't nearly as good a deal for us.
Right. And, do you think that was just because, like, when you're negotiating it yourself, you don't even know what the norm is for what to ask for? So maybe you ask for some stuff that a traditional manager maybe would be, oh, well, we can't ask for that.
We were passionate about the things that we felt like enabled us to survive the way that we knew. The way that we knew how to survive.
Right. And so at this point, you're a pre-season band at that point, touring all the time, doing it your own way.
So it was all about things that would benefit a touring band, because we knew it would be a dead end to take some kind of huge advance. That wasn't in the cards for us. No one was offering one anyway, but that wouldn't have worked for us.
Right.
And but we wanted to be able to continue this thing as a touring band, and so all the things we asked for were all things that kind of, you know, would benefit that type of mindset. And but when we negotiated the New West deal, we were touring and we had a manager, and the manager negotiated basically what made for a better deal from the manager's point of view instead of for our point of view. And and so it wasn't really, you know, there were just things that we never would have really signed off on if we had really been as aware as we needed to be that were part of that deal. And so it made for kind of an uncomfortable relationship. And and New West at that time was you know, they've kind of rebuilt that label, and it's kind of become something different now. That's really, they're doing some really cool stuff. Mm. and we're all on good terms and all that, but the people who were kind of running things at that time were doing it I think they were trying to grow it and become a bigger label. They were wanting to compete with the majors, so they were trying to run this kind of potentially small boutique label more like a major label type thing.
Yeah.
And that wasn't really working for us.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty turbulent period for a long time that went through with that.
You know, drive-by truckers have a reputation as being like a hard living, hard touring band.
Right.
How much of that is myth, and how much of that is truth?
Well, I mean, it depends on what period of time. I mean, you know, you go back in time, we earned the myth. You know, we were. You know,
right.
we. You know, we're all lucky to be here.
Right.
And,
right.
And there's more to hard living than just, you know, abusing yourself.
Sure.
So, touring the amount we tour is still, that's hard living.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, we take care of ourselves. I mean, we don't, you know, nobody drinks to excess anymore, and, or certainly not regularly. And, you know, nobody, you know, there's no other drugs, you know, we all, you know, I'm a pretty avid dope smoker, but you know, but
don't mention crack unless you got some.
Yeah. Yeah. we left all the other drugs way further, long way back down the road.
Yeah.
And don't miss them. You know, I don't miss anything that I, you know, I've never had to give up anything I missed doing.
Yeah.
And I've always tried to keep my vices under close enough scrutiny to where I don't have to totally give up, you know, those that beer I'm so looking forward to at 5 o'clock,
yeah,
you know,
right,
and things
right.
like that. So we're you know, we're definitely hard driving, but we're not that hard living anymore.
Right.
You know, we all have kids. I mean, everybody's got kids, and we're all very devoted dads, every one of us. You know?
And do you still enjoy touring the way that you did when you first started?
Yes and no. Yeah, kind of. I mean, probably more than Mike does, Cooley too. I do love it. I do love it. You know, there were times when we were making that transition from the wild, crazy, you know, wide fucking open days to the more calmed down days where it's like, God, you know, what am I going to find to make this fun now?
Right.
Know?
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
That, you know, now that I'm not, you know, trying to sleep with, you know, everyone that walks through the door
right.
or whatever. But
oh my God, we can go sightseeing.
Yeah. You know, but you know, there's a lot to be said for going sightseeing.
Sure,
you know, it's
sure.
like you get to a point where you kind of find the I never get tired of the show, ever.
Right.
I never get tired of the show. I love, you know, there have been times when there were issues within the band and I wasn't enjoying it. And that's always a really tough time when mm-hmm. I'm not enjoying the show, because that is the payoff.
Right.
But once we got all of that fixed, I mean, you know, I can't wait to play tonight, you
right.
know, with this band. I love the band I've got now. And
yeah.
It's my favorite band. You know, Cooley and I joked that, you know, it took us, you know, 28 years to form our dream band, but we really truly have it now. And we all hang out. We've got an amount of camaraderie like you, when you're in high school, your high school band wants to have. It's
yeah.
kind of like that.
Oh, that's
it's really
great.
Cool.
That's it's hard to maintain that.
It
in a,
really
in a band.
Is. And you know, it'd be a great irony if we keep this lineup together for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, God, they had all this stuff, and then all of a sudden that band just lasted forever, you know,
well, it's
until
funny.
They all died off. You know?
I thought I read a few years ago, maybe a couple years ago, that you guys were like taking a hiatus or something. Usually when I hear the word hiatus, it's like actually means we're breaking up and we just don't quite want to say it.
Right.
But then it seemed like almost right away, maybe you were doing some solo stuff, or, you know, pretty soon the Truckers had a new album out. Like if, am I remembering that right?
Yeah,
was there like a hiatus? Because it didn't seem to last very long.
It didn't. It was kind of like that was probably that last round of personnel changes, which was traumatic. You know, it was hard. It's hard. I hate losing members in the band, you know.
Right.
And you know, the last go-round was involved two different members who kind of left a year apart, but they were a couple, and it made it extra hard. And,
mm.
and there was a lot of kind of unnecessary drama and ugliness associated with it that really caused me to like take stock and like, God, you know, for starters, what you were asking is like, you know, are we doing something wrong? Are we such, are we really bad people that
right.
just no one wants to play with us?
Right.
But it also, right in the midst of that, we kind of landed on what we've got now. And then it's kind of like, well, shit, this is kind of cool. Let's see what we can do with this, you know? And so, you know, we took our version of a hiatus meant we played under 100 shows that year. And
right.
And for us, that kind of was a hiatus, you know? We
yeah.
actually were home more days than we were gone. And that's
yeah.
almost never happened in the last 20 years.
What's but, home like for you? I mean, I know you're married, you got kids. What is right. what is your home life like? Is it... what am I trying to ask? I'm just wondering if there's something about your home life that keeps you grounded, that allows you to be able to go out and do
oh,
this
sure.
crazy thing that you do. You know, you have a crazy job.
Yeah, I do have a crazy job. I've got a wonderful wife, and Rebecca is incredible. And, you know, she we were friends for years before we ever dated, and we've been a couple for almost 14 years. We're about to have our 11th. You know, anniversary as a mm. as a married couple, and she's great, you know, and it's I you know, there's no way I can even fathom trying to balance being a dad and doing this if I didn't have someone like her really enabling me to be able to do it. And you know, and she's a big fan of, you know, she loves music and she loves what I do, and you know, this thing we do. So she's really, really supportive and helpful, and enables me to do it. You know, it's hard. I mean, it's hard
yeah.
for her. She's home alone with the kids a lot, and
yeah.
it sucks. You know, and I'm sure there's times where she wakes up and she goes, you know, what about my life? What about my art? I want to
yeah.
make art.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure.
Like, I'm an artist too.
Yeah.
You know, but and you know, and part of what, you know, we're moving to the West Coast. Actually in a couple of months, and a lot of that is for her benefit, so that she can, you know, it's something that she's really wanting to do, and I'm all about it, and I'm supportive and love the idea and all of that, but you know, it's also a lot is to kind of enable her to kind of, you know, the kids are old enough now to where she can start having a little bit more of an outside life too, and
yeah.
And so this is something that hopefully is going to enable her to do some of the things she's wanting to do. But yeah, we've got, you know, I've got great kids. I'm lucky. They're healthy. Everybody's, you know, all our issues are all dealable, you know,
yeah.
And so and at least moderately fixable, you know.
Yeah.
So it's I'm really lucky.
Let's actually back up a little bit to your childhood.
All right.
Because as you know, probably most people that know who you are know that you're the son of a famous musician
right.
himself, and I'm wondering what that was like growing up for you in Muscle Shoals. Like, were you surrounded by music all the time? Was this like just something that you were sort of born into? Like, were you picking up a guitar when you're 5 years old, like down at the studio all the time, or was it something else?
It was something else. You know, Dad was at the studio all the time. I mean, to do what he did, you had to be, you
right.
know, and he was young, and they were, you know, I basically had teenage parents, and my dad was two when he started really doing sessions. Before that, he worked at a tire store, at his dad's tire store, which was ironically like two doors down the street from Fame Studios. It was right there. And so he would get off work at the tire store and walk over to the studio and try to see if he could land a session for that night, you know, and stuff like that. And then on weekends, he would play in a cover band that played like frat parties all over the South, that, you know, like Animal House. I mean, literally playing
really?
Louie and,
yeah.
and you know, oh God, what's that great? Woolly Bully.
You're right.
You know,
yeah, yeah,
Dad
sure.
sang Woolly Bully. I think that was the one they let him sing. You know, he'd sing Woolly Bully and Shout. They'd do all that stuff.
Yeah,
And they were four piece, and the Beatles blew up, and so they all kind of got Beatle haircuts, you know, and started wearing the matching suits like the Beatles. And
they,
you know, they were making money playing frat parties that my band is really probably only in the last few years made per night.
You're
some
right.
of those, just because they were, you know, doing that music at that time and all that. And his first session was Warm and Tender Love by Percy Sledge. And I think he played trombone on I'm Your Puppet. I think that might have been before that, but his first session as a bass player, which is his main instrument, was the follow-up to When a Man Loves a Woman. And and then all of a sudden he was playing on all these records, you know, and tons of them. So he really didn't come home a lot. And, you know, and he and
was mom, he the one that got you into music, or was it like, you know, the kid down the street that you went to school with that turned you on to the Sex Pistols or something? You
well,
know what I mean? Like,
how,
where did
collection.
It come from?
He had the record collection.
Okay.
And he wasn't really home, but his record collection was.
Right.
And as I got a little older, you know, I wasn't really supposed to touch Dad's records, but I figured out that, you know, my dad's very kind of anal retentive and meticulous about his stuff. I figured out if I was really careful and put them back exactly the right way, that I could get away with it.
Right.
And so I would come home from school and go downstairs to, quote unquote, do my homework, and I'd put on I'd put on headset, and I'd play records, you know, for hours. So that was my education. If it had a cool album cover, I'd put it on, which is why to this day I'm so fanatical about the packaging for our records, because I love a great album
oh,
cover.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how else would you be drawn to anything in a record store when you're a kid?
That's why I'm so passionate
yeah.
about vinyl, you know?
Yeah.
My first job as a teenager was at a record store.
Really?
I got a job at a record bar in the mall in Florence, and I worked there for 5 years. And before I worked there, I just hung out at the record stores in town, to the point to where, I mean, they, you know, everybody at the record stores knew me. You know,
right.
I was, even as a kid, I kind of had very grown-up taste and was really knowledgeable about it. I mean, I read, you know, Dad would have Billboard. So I'd read Billboard back front to back. I'd read Rolling Stone front to back. I'd read Musician front to back. I was like encyclopedic
right.
in my knowledge of music from the time I was, you know, literally like 10 or 11 years old. And,
I mean, did you stick out like a sore thumb in Muscle Shoals? I mean, I imagine you must.
We didn't go to church. I mean, yeah, I really stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, you know, what church do you go to? You know, my sister's coined a phrase, we home church. But, I mean, I did. I didn't like football. I wasn't good at sports.
Yeah.
I was, you know, it's Alabama in the 70s. Yeah,
yeah.
I was less than zero. I was negative. And, you know, and I wasn't really supposed to talk about what Dad did. You know, I kind of learned the hard way, or not the hard way myself. I watched another one of Dad's partners had a son my age, and we were in class together in second grade. And I can remember him standing up in show and tell, talking about, my dad's the best drummer in the world, and he's doing this and doing that. And then seeing him about an hour later getting the shit pounded out of him, you know, in the playground. I thought, okay, we're not going to talk about dad.
Yeah, note to self. Yeah, don't bring that up.
Don't talk about dad.
Yeah.
And so I didn't. I didn't talk about dad until I was in my 30s when I moved to Athens.
Isn't that funny? I mean, as a parent now, you know, because I go through this. I'm sure you go through this. You know, your kids and all the other parents, everybody thinks that, like, it's so cool. You're like the token musician dad at the school. Like, how funny is that? What a turnaround.
Yeah.
You know, that you would have gotten your ass kicked
for
having, you know, you as a dad.
Right.
You know, 30, 40 years ago.
And, you know, my kids are growing up in a much different environment because Athens, Georgia is, whereas Muscle Shoals has this huge musical history and legacy, when I was growing up, it was all happening in a couple of buildings, you know, and it was all secret. No one knew. No one
with
knew
when the Rolling Stones. Drawn.
You know, no one knew when the Rolling Stones came to town. Are you kidding? They would have, shut them down if they'd known. You know,
really?
It was all secret. But whereas Athens is kind of built on bands and live music and this kind of, you know, the art school at the university and all that, which kind of spawned the original music scene there and. You know, it's a town with 150,000 people, but there's, you know, 300 bands.
Right.
And so it's an, you know, at my kid's school, there's a lot of parents who are in bands.
Right.
You know, our band's probably one of the better known ones, but there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the kids' parents are in bands.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that too, because I was thinking, you know, growing up in Alabama, what drew you to Athens instead of, you know, New York or Nashville or Atlanta or one of the bigger cities around there? I mean, I know Athens has like a rich musical history.
For sure.
But all these other places do too. And, you know, I'm just curious as to why you picked that one.
I mean, it would have been way more convenient to move to Nashville for sure, because Nashville was 2 hours away and Athens was 6 hours away. I stayed a long time. I mean, I stayed in my hometown until I was, you know, I was basically 30 when I moved to Athens. And because I didn't want to leave my family. I mean, I was very close to my grandmother and my great uncle, and, you know, they were still alive but getting very old, and I didn't want to move far away from them. And but at that time, Nashville's, you know, really gone through a lot of changes. I mean, Nashville is like super cool now, and a lot happening besides Music Row. In fact, Music Row's
hustling
kind
and
of having trouble, but everything else has just exploded there.
Yeah.
And so many bands and so much rock and all that. But in the early 90s, when I decided it was time for me to relocate, there wasn't really a scene to speak of in Nashville other than people trying to make it in the business.
Right.
And the business, you know, I grew up, I kind of had figured out the business didn't have a place for me. There wasn't a place, it wasn't a seat at the table for me with in you know, the bands I was going to be in wasn't going to get signed.
Right.
And so I needed to be somewhere that could nurture a band that wasn't looking to get signed, that wanted to do it myself. And Athens had that. They had great venues that I could play when I come home from touring, and lots of creative musicians to try to build a band out of. And, you know, I moved to town and I got a job working sound at a club, and then working sound at two other clubs. And, you know, I worked, you know, 5-6 nights a week and kind of immersed myself in the local scene and learned, you know, who was who in every band and all of that. And while I was kind of working on my evil plan, you know, for what became this band.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how exactly you classify your own music. You know, I think of you guys as like, you know, kind of part of an Americana world, or maybe with some Southern rock stuff thrown in there and some punk rock. But do you get much like kind of recognition by the sort of the mainstream Nashville world?
I don't think a lot. I mean, a little bit. I mean, you know, I mean, our band gets treated great. We're respected. We get treated real good. People say nice things about us generally.
Yeah.
You know, I don't always agree with the things they say about us, but they're generally meant in a nice way, you know.
Right,
but You know, we've never really been a band that fit into any nice spot. You know, we've always been the square peg for any round hole they've tried to put us in.
Right.
And I think that's probably been part of our longevity.
Sure.
But it also has been part of us never really quite hitting that next level, you know, and which is fine because I'm pretty okay with where we ended up. But yeah. You know, I've always thought of us as a rock and roll band, just plain and simple. You know, to me, when I think of rock and roll, it incorporates all these different subgenres, most of which I really love. I mean, I love all these different things. You know,
sure.
I love old-timey country, and
yeah.
we've got a band that has flirted with that, and I love R&B, and we've made a country soul record, and I love, you know, I grew up on arena rock, and we've made a record about that. You know, the Southern Rock Opera was so steeped in that, and probably to the point of getting us a little bit typecasted, you know, and we get called that, you know, that Southern Rock word that I don't necessarily embrace sometimes. Because I don't really think of us as that way. Because
right.
to me, it's like, well, that's a part of what we've done, but that's
sure.
not, that doesn't define us to me.
Right.
And so I kind of, and of course, there's been few things on earth I've loved more than punk rock. That was my dad and I's, that was our generation gap was,
right.
that was when all of a sudden his record collection and my record collection started looking different was when I fell in love with punk rock.
Right.
And which, you know, that all like happened. I was in like seventh grade when the Sex Pistols came to America.
Yeah.
And when the Clash first record came out and all of that. So that was like a turning point in my dad and I's relationship with music.
Was that also when you first started playing in bands? Would that have been around the same time?
More or less. I got my first guitar around that time. And, you know, dad and I never sat around and played. Wasn't particularly encouraging me of me doing it. He
right.
he wanted to see me do something different. I don't think he really thought I had what it takes to do this. You
right.
know, and
what does it take to do this? What was the criteria that he was?
I think
making
for,
that
well,
judgment.
He's a session guy.
Right.
So his criteria, a lot of it came on being technically right on. And you know, I was a punk rock kid. I
right.
wasn't technically right. I'm still not technically
sure.
right on, you
yeah.
know. It was always more about the wild abandon and the feel and the and he didn't really get that. He does now. I
yeah.
mean, we're you know, our relationship's very different now as far as music goes than it was then. But you know, he loves all those bands now that I loved that he used to hate, you know.
Right.
But and he's made records with some of those people now.
Oh, really?
You know, he's out
How
on the
funny.
Road now with the Waterboys. He's playing bass for the Waterboys right
really?
Now.
Really?
Yeah, they're coming here actually soon. But they're playing the Fonda in a few weeks. But but he's the bass player in the Waterboys. He's the bass player on their new record. He was just on Letterman
cool.
the other day. And you know, and that would have been a record that I would have been, you know, Fisherman's Blues was a record that I was into when I was in high school. That
right.
He probably wouldn't have gotten at the time.
Turn that crap off.
Yeah. You
yeah.
know, the Pixies, that was a big one. I love the Pixies, and he did not. And he's played on like two Frank Black records now, and they're buddies, you know.
Wow.
He and Charles are friends, you know.
Oh,
it's
that
so
is
crazy.
So bizarre.
So,
that's so cool.
And so, you know, he's come very much full circle. But,
do you have any of the old gear from the Muscle Shoals studio?
No,
I think I read somewhere that you guys make a lot of your records on tape or
right.
analog and all that. So I was wondering if you had gone in and like, you know, gotten any of that wow. good old gear.
You know, there's this funny story kind of like that. This guy got in touch with us it's been about 10 years now. And he claimed to have the old 16 track 2-inch from that had been at Muscle Shoals Sound. He claimed it was the original 3614 2-inch. And he was a old man, and he was kind of liquidating his stuff and getting rid of it. And he's like, you know, it's not working right now. I don't know what it would take to fix it. I don't want any money for it, but I'm going to get rid of it. And I thought you might be interested. If you can come get it, you can have it. And we were touring, like, I mean, nonstop. And so we had a guy who worked for us kind of off and on crew. We hired him while we were touring. I think we were touring Europe at the time, and he was part of our American crew. That's what it was. And so we hired him while we were touring Europe to rent a truck and drive up to, it's like in Jersey or somewhere.
Oh, wow.
And pick this thing up. And it's huge. I mean, it's the size of this, you know, that wall right there.
Yeah.
And bring it back. And we put it in storage at David Barbie Studio, and now it's at our headquarters and all that. And it's still sitting there and all that. But years pass, and Jimmy Johnson from Muscle Shoals Sound and fame and all of that,
yeah.
He came to town to, I can't remember what he was in town for, but he was doing something. And so David Barbie took him over. It's like, hey, I think you may get a kick out of this.
Yeah.
Showed it to him. It's like, recognize this? And he's like, no. Like, I've never seen this before in my life. So,
really?
So it looks a lot like the one they had
that
you see in Gimme Shelter.
It's
that era.
And right.
It looks similar to the one that they had then, but it's not the one.
Yeah.
So, that's a long answer for your question, but it's
funny.
Not, we don't really have much of it.
Right.
You know, so much of that stuff got lost along the way, too.
Right, I'm sure. Yeah, because people aren't sentimental about that kind of stuff at the time.
At the time,
you know.
And I mean, you know, the studio, they sold the studio. Dad sold Muscle Shoals Sound in the 80s and to Malico Records out of Jackson that does, like, gospel records
and
kind of really low-budget R&B records.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff that at that time they would, like, sell on TV, you know, and Bobby Blues Bland's new record, you know, for, you know, $9.95,
right,
three easy payments, you know, and so they bought it, and, you know, they didn't really take care of a lot of the stuff, and a lot of stuff kind of got into disrepair before they ended up totally kind of liquidating that studio. But now there's this huge thing where they're, you know, they're like, they've gone in and a nonprofit has, like, acquired the old original Muscle Shoals Sound building, and they're doing this, like, amazing renovation of it and putting, like, you know, gear that's true to the era and all
Wow.
And I think, like, Dr. Dre and the Beats thing is like is like helping finance some of the stuff that's going on with it.
Cool.
So they're doing all this, you know, like I said, I mean, my hometown is, like, now fiercely aware of and proud of their musical heritage.
I mean, do you find with your dad, because I've found this with lots of older musicians from that generation, even before that generation, that they're, like, we all sit there and you know, kind of get into all the gear and, like, you know, it's got to be the 1956 that or the 1962 this thing. And for those guys, they were just playing the thing that was the newest thing at that time. And they're not sentimental about it at all.
At
a lot of times when you meet these guys, they want the new thing from now.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're not like, I want my, they're like, that's the old shit. You know what I mean? Like, is your dad like that? Or just did he hang on to all his old gear?
He did hang on to his stuff. And I mean, he's basically used the same amp in the studio for, you know, for most of his career. He had a specific thing he used, and there's been, you know, a few basses that have come and gone, but his prize bass got stolen when he was in Traffic. He toured with Traffic for 2 years in 72 and 73, and I think it was the end of the 72 tour, they stole the bass that he played, I'll Take You There and Respect Yourself and Tell Mama and all those songs on this, like, 60 or 61 jazz bass. And it was, I think it was his first ever bass.
Oh,
and it
man.
Got stolen from a locker at JFK on that tour.
Really?
And
maybe that, like, he'll have a Peter Frampton moment where he gets the guitar back after 30 years. I know you
amazing.
Do a lot of solo stuff,
right.
Make solo records, do solo tours and stuff like that. How do you figure out, you know, when a song is a drive-by trucker song and when it's a Patterson Hood song?
It's been weird. I've done three
And does
records.
Your band ever get grumpy at you? Like, whoa,
no.
Bro, hey, bring
no.
that thing over.
No, never anything like that. And, you know, it's... You know, my first solo record was an accident. I mean, it was just some stuff I recorded in my dining room, and I was writing a lot. I was going through a divorce, and the band was going through a horrific time. We were trying to finish Southern Rock Opera, and it was, I mean, we were out of money, and everybody's relationships at home are all breaking up. Cooley actually managed to stay married to his wife, but everybody else was getting divorced, and we're all just flat broke. And you know, it's the era when you come home from a tour and your stuff is sitting out on the street, literally.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that happened to our drummer, and right at that time, and it had gotten to the point where it had been going on long enough to where we had started taking it out on each other, and it had gotten really kind of just, I mean, I didn't really think we were going to manage. It's like, how are we going to even stay together to finish this damn record?
Mm.
But it's like, we can't break up until we at least finish this record and tour behind it. We've got to at least get through this.
I've been thinking this idea for 6 years. God damn it.
I've been going all over the country talking about it, and I'm just going to look like such a total loser if I can't follow through on this crazy idea. Because everybody we'd tell the idea to, they'd tell us it was the craziest, stupidest idea they ever heard. And so, we'll show you, you know, it's going to be great. You know, and so we stayed together for that, and then it all worked out. But during that period, I wrote a shitload of songs, and a lot of those songs became the record, Decoration Day.
Oh, okay.
Which while I was writing it was the working title on that album was Heathens, and I had I probably had 75 songs for that record written.
Wow.
And so I was doing just demoing songs in my dining room, and no one speaking to each other, and just a rough time. And I decided I need to get out of town because of the divorce and everything. It was getting so ugly. And so I booked a solo tour, and I didn't have anything to sell. And so I just pressed up. I took a bunch of the songs. I thought, well, okay, I know this song is going to go on the Heathens record, but this song probably won't. So I made a 12-song or 13-song sequence of songs that I just figured wouldn't go on that record. And I called it Killers and Stars, and I just sold it, made them myself, and sold them at gigs just for merch to sell.
Mm.
And then years later, after we had a record deal, and around the time we put out the Dirty South, the label we were on, people, you know, had continued kind of talking about this record. It had kind of built its own little bit of a thing, and so they asked if they could put it out, and so that's how that one happened. It was just kind of an accident. And then the second album, Murdering Oscar, was made up. A lot of the songs on that were songs that predated the Truckers. When I started the Truckers, we started it with brand new songs, and you know, we went back later and may have picked up a few songs from the earlier days that we've incorporated in, but we started the band with brand new stuff. So there was all this stuff from a 2-year period right before that didn't get used, and I really liked some of those songs. So I thought, I'm gonna make a record out of those. And then I started listening to them going, well, my life has really changed now. So I wrote other songs to counterpoint the old songs,
guys,
to bring it more up to date.
Sure.
And that's the second album.
Oh, wow.
And then the third one was Heat Lightning. And I'm extra proud of that one. That's one of the things I'm proudest of, probably of anything I've ever done. But and it came about, you know, the Truckers made two records at the same time a few years ago. We did The Big To Do and Go-Go Boots.
Sure.
And then it was decided for business reasons to release them basically a year apart.
Right.
So we basically spent 3 years, a 3-year touring cycle behind two records. And kind of early in that cycle, I wrote this kind of group of songs around my great uncle, who was kind of like a father to me, who helped raise me, passing away.
Mm.
And some other songs related to this book I'd been trying to write that it kind of morphed into songs and didn't really work as a book. And so I had this album's worth of songs, and I knew if I put it in line for the Truckers, it'd be another 5 years before I got to do anything with it. And I wanted to do something right then with it. And
right.
So, and we were having issues in the band too. It was, we were still going through some personal problems and personnel changes, stuff that maybe hadn't happened yet, but was probably leading up to it. And so it kind of felt liberating just to go in the studio with and just invite who I wanted for specific songs and make this record. And so that's how that one happened. So my general operating thing is, if I'm writing a song, I'm generally thinking of it in terms of it being a trucker record,
right?
And especially right now, because the band's such a good place.
Yeah, I mean, do you write all the time? I mean, you have such an enormous amount of output. I'm curious as to sort of your songwriting process, like time you spend.
Yeah, I used to write all the time, and I miss that. If I could change something about my life, that would be high on the list. That might be the thing that really comes to mind the most, is I would love to have more time to spend on my writing. Mm-hmm. And because I'd get such satisfaction out of it when it goes good. But it's, I mean, I started writing when I was 8, and I would sit in class. I'd write in class, and my grades were terrible.
Right.
You can look on my report cards and tell the month I started writing songs. You know, it's when I went from being an AB student to a CD student.
Right.
And that's what I did until I dropped out of college, and then I didn't have a life, so I continued writing all the time.
Yeah.
But when the band really kind of took off, all of a sudden I've got all this other shit I got to do. And so it's been a real tough, trying to carve out the necessary time. And I've been lucky. I've been able to make it work, but it is really hard, just finding the time. I'm always have them percolating, but the actual time to just sit down and let my mind wander the amount it takes. Cause if I'm sitting there and my mind's wandering, someone's going to put a broom in my hand and say, "Hey, this needs doing," especially right now with small kids, I come home from tour, I want to be dad. I don't want to be locked in a room, be the troubled artist all day long,
absolutely.
So I owe them that.
Yeah.
So it's hard, but it's a work in progress. I still get lucky. I got a new one right now. And so I'm free and clear for a little bit longer.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's cool. I put up on my Facebook page that I was interviewing you and asked if anybody had any good questions. So if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind asking you a couple of those. And the one that really popped out to me, because I don't know if this references a song of yours or what, but it says, "Ask him about the night G.G. Allin came to town."
We did that song last night. We pulled that out last night for The Dirt Underneath. And first time we've played it in a pretty good while. But that's a love song I wrote to Cooley when during that time when we kind of weren't really hanging out. It was before the Truckers, and it was during that time between the breakup of our third band together and starting the Truckers, when we I don't know if we were totally at outs, but we weren't hanging out. And I wrote in that song as like a birthday present. When our first band, we spent 6 years in a band called Adam's House Cat, and when mm-hmm. it broke up, it damn near killed me. I mean, I mourned the loss of that band like you grieve a loved one dying or something, and I think he did too. We really had our heart and soul in that band, and it was a good band. It was a really good band. We had a great drummer, and we both moved to Memphis right at that time together, and in hopes of relocating the band, and that's kind of ended up breaking the band up. And and we were living there, and I was I've been divorced twice, so it was my first divorce. It was a really rough time of life, and we were just flat broke, living in just abject poverty basically. During that time, G.G. Allin came and played the Antenna Club, which is like the historic punk rock bar in Memphis. Everybody played there during that era that came through. I think U2 played there once.
Oh, wow.
And REM played there in the early days. And we played one of our last, Adam's House Cat played one of our last shows there. It wasn't anything we really had any interest in going to or anything like that, but it happened while we were there. And we would go eat lunch every Sunday. We would just pool whatever resources together we could have to go eat this like one meal a week that was like our sit down decent meal. And we'd go to this Meat and Three right down from where we lived called Ferguson's. And we'd always, of course, we'd be hungover, and I'm sure just stinking, we weren't bathing much. we would get there, it'd be Sunday by the time church let out. So the place would fill up with all these like old couples in their Sunday best. And Cooley and I looked like, you know, something from, you know, the Rolling Stones, you know, cocksucker blues era Rolling Stones or something.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there waiting for a macaroni and cheese. And this old couple at the table next to us is reading the weekly and waiting for their macaroni and cheese. And he's reading about Gigi Allen's show in town and commenting on it to his wife. And we were sitting there and we couldn't help but hear him. And he talked like Thurston Howell from right. Gilligan's Island.
Sure.
And it was even looked like that. And his wife kind of looked like Lovey from, you know, and we were
perfect.
Watching that and we were laughing so hard that we were like, you know, literally like spitting food out. We were laughing so hard listening to him comment about Gigi Allen.
When two worlds collide.
Yeah.
Man,
so
Jesus.
I wrote that song about it. And like I said, and we did it last night. Maybe we'll do it tonight. Yeah.
Oh, funny, man. One of the questions, and this is too much like homework, so I'm not going to hold you to the whole answer, but maybe just pick one. It said, ask him his favorite country song from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Oh, wow.
One
like
from
homework.
Each. But why don't you just pick one?
Yeah.
From, you know, an old, what's your favorite, you know, old time honky tonk tune?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, you know, I'm so lonesome I could cry is just probably... Yeah. You know, one of the best, two or three best songs ever written by anybody ever.
Doesn't get much better than that.
That's kind of the one that pops in my head immediately. But you know, I love old Loretta Lynn songs too. The Other Woman and really any of those early era Loretta Lynn songs.
And she wrote a lot of those too.
She wrote
that was not common in those days. Yeah.
No, she was so great.
Yeah.
And
she's a real pioneer.
Yeah. So I love that, you know, and I love even a lot of the, you know, countrypolitan, you know, I love, you know, Charlie Rich's Behind Closed Doors. We actually have been talking about working up The Most Beautiful Girl in the World by Charlie Rich as a song for us to do on this Dirt Underneath tour. Cooley was going to sing it. We hadn't gotten around to doing it, but we keep talking about working that up.
Yeah.
Do you have much
of this tour left? Is it going for a while?
We're about a third. I guess we've done about a third of it. We've gotten the kinks ironed out, I think, now.
Yeah.
We're hitting L.A. pretty good. We had a really good show last night.
Nice.
And first couple shows were a little bumpy. We had to figure out some technical stuff about how to make this work.
Right.
You know?
Technical things like, how do I play my song?
Yeah, that's a big one. And
speaking of that, on that end, would you like to play us a song?
Sure.
That would be
sure.
Awesome. And thank you so much for coming and doing this today. I know you're taking time
Man,
out of
thank you.
Being
it's
on the road,
great.
And I appreciate it. I know, you know, a lot of times when I'm touring, the last thing on earth I want to do is be like... forced out of my hotel room, so I really appreciate it, man.
Well, I've gotten to spend the afternoon having Mexican food and hanging out with a cool guy, so you know, so it's been a lot of fun. I've
That's
really
right.
had a great time.
Cool, man. Thank you. Here, I'll go get your guitar.
All righty. Tell me when you're ready.
I'm good to go. We're recording.
All righty. Yeah, since someone had written in a question about it, maybe play The Night Gigi Allen Came to Town. We were bored. There was nothing going. Might as well stay at home, drink until we pass out again, and drink some more when the morning comes. Memphis was sinking to the Mississippi. Doing our best just to ride it down. Till the night Gigi Allen came to town. The night Gigi Allen came to town. Honey, I don't believe this. The old man at Ferguson's Cafe kept saying to his wife as he read aloud, the Memphis Flyer and their account of what went down that night. He says he took a shit on the stage. Started throwing it into the crowd, but he was gone before the cops could come and shut him down. Gone before the shit came down. The night G.G. Allin came to town, and Antenna Club Memphis 1991, punk rockers paid $12 to be shat upon. The night G.G. Allin came to town, the night G.G. Allin came to town.
Tune. Never in the history of music has the name G.G. Allin sounded so damn good, so lyrical, so melodic. All right, that was Patterson Hood on Walking the Floor. Make sure you go to drivebytruckers.com to see where on earth they are touring, because you know they're touring somewhere or making a new record or doing something. I think he also has a website, PattersonHood.com, for his solo stuff, so check that out, too. Okay, I'm going to go take a nap, try to get ready for Edinburgh. I love you. Hola, señores and señoritas. Walking.